Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.
Please join me in welcoming representatives Larry Gonzalez, Paul Workman, Jason Eisen. Good to see you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Congratulations to the three of you.
Thank you.
And I guess, are you sure now, having assessed the state of the state, that you really want this job? You all knew coming in it was going to be tough. Did you know it was going to be this tough?
Yes, sir.
You did. Check.
This will be session number 10 for me. I'm very familiar and very aware with the sacrifices that our elected leaders do to get here, and very aware of the gravity of what all this means.
You both understand, as Mr. Gonzalez knows a little bit more about this, having been in the building for many years, you understand the enormity of what you're about to face.
He doesn't understand anything about construction.
Go on.
It is a little different. I was fortunate to have been the chairman of the board of a statewide construction association, so I had some exposure to the process and got an opportunity to learn some about it. And I've certainly got a lot to learn, but I think I'm at least got a my eyes are partially opened as to what we're getting into.
Now, Mr. Isaac, you've had lacrosse balls flung at your head. This isn't going to be much different than that.
not much, no.
It's already started, hasn't it?
It has. It was amazing. On November 3rd, the world completely changed as I know it. At that point in time, I'd probably been in the beautiful Pink Dome building there maybe six times.
As a visitor,
yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it'll be exciting, and we're looking forward to the challenges we face.
Well, we're going to talk today about a number of the big issues that you're going to face that will be enormously difficult related to the budget and redistricting and immigration and many things that are on the agenda today that may not have been on the agenda on November the 1st. But let me ask you immediately about the first vote you're going to have to cast, and that is for Speaker of the Texas House. Yeah, very funny. This smells like a line that DeLisi cooked up in his conference room. What do you think? Okay, I'll give you that. That's good. Mr. Gonzalez,
yes,
you had
sir.
Previously been pledged to the Speaker, and you are unpledged to the Speaker. Why?
I am neutral at this point. Per the request of my constituents, they asked me to step back and evaluate every candidate and listen to the spiel that everybody had and to make the best choice I could when that time came.
We're only within a couple days. What more do you need to hear?
Well, I'm looking forward to January the 10th. When one by one, they stand up there and tell us why they should be Speaker of the House.
Mr. Isaac has come out visibly in favor of the vote in the caucus. Are you in favor of a caucus vote?
I am.
You are. Mr.
Yes.
Workman, are you in favor of a caucus vote?
Yes.
Okay, you all believe the caucus vote should be open as opposed to closed? Should the ballot be open as opposed to closed?
In a caucus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
You're okay with an open vote? You're okay with an open vote?
Yeah, I'm still undecided on that. Either way would be
what's
fine.
What's the issue for you that makes you undecided?
The goal is to get us into caucus, and I think that's something that I have clearly supported, as you say, and I certainly support that. And again, we're freshmen. We don't know all the rules of the caucus or the House, for that matter, and we don't know the rules on a closed ballot or an open ballot. And I just think it'd be good for us and be healthy for us to get into caucus and talk about these issues.
Mr. Workman, open vote or closed vote?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by open. Are you talking about open to the public or open within the caucus?
Open within the caucus.
Open within the caucus. Yeah, that would be fine.
You two, open within the caucus. You're just not sure.
I'm still on the fence on that one. No.
Mr. Isaac, you are not pledged to anybody.
Correct.
But you are a member of the Tea Party caucus that Senator Patrick and others convened.
Yes.
There is an assumption that members of that caucus, not all of them, because I believe Representative Eisler, who is a fan of Mr. Strauss's, is a member of that caucus. But it is assumed that many people in that caucus are not Strauss guys.
I don't know where that assumption comes from. I believe that caucus is really put together so that we could listen to the Tea Party folks. And I think that's an important caucus for us to have. That's a big movement across this state. And I think it's critical that we have that caucus.
There are no tea leaves to be read, in other words, as far as your involvement in that group and your intentions for next Tuesday.
No.
Right. Why haven't you declared your preference yet?
I'm still listening. And there's going to be a lot of votes that we make this session, but we need to wait until the last minute to hear from our constituents. And we've got some great feedback. I've been hearing from a lot of our constituents in House District 45, and I'm continuing to listen to them.
And again, is there something you're going to hear between now and Monday or now and Tuesday that makes it so you can't tell us your intention now, But you'll have a vote then?
It's possible. I still get feedback every single day, multiple times a day.
Right.
So it's possible.
Mr. Workman, like Mr. Gonzalez, the belief is that you had been pledged to the Speaker and then you unpledged.
Well, that is sort of true. I have not withdrawn my card from the Speaker, but certainly I've heard a lot from constituents about the Speaker's race. And it's given me pause to stop and look at it. But, you know, we really need to go on, get past that, and get on with the people's business. Right. We'll have a speaker on January the 11th, and I'm not sure who that's going to be, but we need to talk about the economy of the state of Texas.
Do you believe, Mr. Workman, though, that the identity of the speaker or the choice of the members will have an impact on the people's business?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that it will, but with a 101 majority, I think the Speaker, even as powerful as he is, will have some limited amount of effect on what bills actually make it to the floor.
Why is that?
Well, just because the committees will be made up of at least two-thirds of conservative Republicans, and it's going to be hard to keep those bills from coming out of a committee which is made up of that strong of a group.
Mr. Gonzalez, you agree?
I think that every candidate that I've seen for Speaker of the House and that I've spoken to is perfectly capable of leading a conservative agenda this session. I have no doubts about that.
But you know that the Speaker will, of course, appoint committee chairs, and there is some controversy over whether the current Speaker's past committee chairs were sufficiently conservative. Are you comfortable that Mr. Strauss is sufficiently conservative to be Speaker if he is the choice of the House?
I think the 82nd legislature has a breakup of 101 to 49. Every candidate that I've heard from and I've spoken to, I think every one of them are absolutely capable of leading a conservative House.
Is he sufficiently conservative to be Speaker?
I think so.
Is he sufficiently conservative, Mr. Isaac, to be Speaker?
Yeah, I think so. I think all the candidates are.
Mr. Workman, is he sufficiently conservative? Okay. Let's move into the, if you're not going to tell, I could ask you again, but you're not going to tell me who you're going to vote
for. That's right.
Let's move into the business of the people. We don't know the size of the shortfall yet. We'll know a little bit more on Monday when the comptroller releases her revenue estimate. We think it's going to be Monday morning. Right. Not much of a news day on Monday, obviously. The question, though, no matter what the size of the revenue estimate is and whatever the size of the shortfall is, you all are going to have some very hard choices to make. As my colleague, Mr. Ramsey, points out, of a $181 billion biennial budget, only about $81 billion is unrestricted. The great majority of the money that's unrestricted that can be cut is in higher ed, public ed, and health and human services.
Right.
Mr. Isaac, where do you go first to cut the budget?
I think one area that you look at is open positions within the state agencies right now. That's about, I've seen projections out there, $1.2 to $1.3 billion could
These
be eliminated.
These are jobs that are unfilled that would just simply be unfilled.
Correct.
Yeah,
I think that's one area, one key area where you look that doesn't hurt anybody specifically.
And you want to talk about public ed, higher ed, health and human services. Is there money to be cut that you can identify for us? Do you think areas of those programs that we should be targeting?
Not that I can identify right now, but there certainly it's going to be painful for everyone. Everyone's going to have to make cuts. I know that, and I think the legislation is going to do it to ourselves. When I first learned of our budget, I immediately said we're going to learn to do with 10% less. We're asking state agencies to make these tough cuts, and we've got to set the examples in the Capitol. So we cut our state office budget 10%. We're going to cut our per diems, I believe, at least 10%, and then do that officially to ourselves in the House probably on the first or second day.
In the end,
can I have your 10%? Because I'm short.
Yeah, we all are.
in the end, Mr. Isaac, though, what's going to be asked of state agencies and other people who are receiving state money right now is likely to be more than 10%. Will every House member and every House office pledge to cut an equivalent percentage from its budget? Will you all pledge to cut an equivalent percent from your budget if state agencies and others are asked to cut more than 10%?
Yes.
Yeah. If we can get the Senate to do it, then I think the House will do it as well.
Can you get the Senate to do it, Mr. Workman?
I can't get anybody to do anything.
You want to persuade the Senate to do it? Mr. Workman, where should we cut? You understand, again, that very high percentage of what we're talking about are dollars that go to people who voted for all of you. It's not just cutting schools, it's cutting schools in Travis County and in Hayes County and in Williamson County, health care in Travis and Hayes and Williamson. Where do you go?
The overriding thing is that we have to do, whatever we do, we have to do it without increasing taxes. And I'll tell you a story. I have a friend that was a senior project manager at Motorola for 15 or 20 years, left there and went to a startup for about 5 or 6 years. The company got in trouble. He got laid off. He's been out of work for over 2 years. How can I possibly look at him and say, I know it's been tough on you, but we're going to raise your taxes? And we're just not going to do that. We will do it with within the available revenue. And I'm not sure. The budget is 400 or 500 pages, and it entails many, many items, and all of those are going to have to be looked at. And each agency is going to have to look at their individual line items, hopefully starting from zero and working their way up to come to a budget that will work. Maybe there are things out there they don't need to do anymore that they need to identify. Yes, it will be tough on some state employees.
Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Workman says he doesn't support new taxes. Who does support new taxes right now?
None of my colleagues, I don't think. You know, Evan, here's the question. If you've got expenses here and, you know, revenue here, you have two choices. You either raise your revenues to get here or you cut your expenses to get here. And so the premise that I'm walking into this with is we need to cut our expenses to meet our revenues. What I've seen from the agencies that I like a lot is I've noticed that our agencies are doing a very good job of getting to that number. I haven't seen anybody that, say, getting to 10%, goes 10% across the board. It's been interesting to watch them, I think, with more of a scalpel than a sledgehammer. Line item by line item, they're going to get to that number. But it may mean that someone loses 0%, maybe a line item loses 100%, maybe someone loses 30%. It's an exercise of reprioritizing what we do as a state government. And the agencies, I feel, are doing a great job of doing that because there are cuts and there are efficiencies. Cuts are the immediate, short-term, get to a number. Efficiencies are a well-thought-out plan, longer-scale model for how you get to a number. And so what I've seen that I like is more of an efficiency model from the agencies going through there and just with a scalpel understanding and reprioritizing what it is they do. And as long as they get to that number, I think we'll be in great shape.
But you're talking about a biennial budget. We're just talking about 2 years. In 2 years, short-term cuts and deficiencies ultimately happen over the same very small time frame.
But you are framing going forward past that.
You like Mr. Workman, oppose all new taxes.
That's correct.
Mr. Isaac, you like Mr. Workman, Mr. Gonzalez, I'm guessing, oppose all new taxes.
Correct.
Do you also oppose, Mr. Isaac, all new revenue? There is a distinction that has been made about new taxes and new revenue. Mrs. Wohlgemuth, former member of the House, now at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, among others, has been advocating for not just no tax revenue, but no revenue period, that we simply have to live within the existing revenue footprint, so any increases in fees, no, gambling, no, no revenue of any kind. Mr. Isaac, where are you on that?
When you say all new revenue, again, it's a definite. And I would have to say, no, I'm not in favor of looking for additional revenue. One area in particular is the Texas State Securities Board, where we have this opportunity where this agency brings in about $194 million a year to our general revenue at a cost of $6.9 million. That agency recently has increased their authority because of the Dodd-Frank legislation, which they've gone from managing and overseeing companies who have funds that are approximately $25 million. Now they have that authority up to $100 million. So it's where we've had these Texans who are making these investments who have been at risk. I kind of refer to them as the mini Madoffs. We're not hearing about them. We're not protecting Texans, but it's bringing in a significant portion of revenue to our general fund. They've asked for 10 additional new employees because they've gone, again, from $25 million to $100 million of companies' managed funds. So I think that's something that the governor has signed off on, but the LBB has restricted those. That's an opportunity for us to protect Texans and their investments and also bring in new revenue to the state.
So you are open to the idea of some new revenue. It's just a question of which new revenue.
Yes.
How about gambling? You like gambling?
No, I don't.
You're opposed to gambling?
Yes.
If a gambling vote comes up, whether it's casinos or racinos or anything else, you're opposed?
Yes.
Mr. Gonzalez?
No, I'm a no.
You're a no on gambling? A solid no?
Solid no.
No wiggle room?
No.
Mr. Workman, even if you got to build those casinos, you would. bite your tongue, Mr. Workman. Come on now.
I am opposed to gambling.
Solid no.
Solid no.
A hard no. Is there anything that any of the three of you could hear that would make the argument change your mind on that?
On gambling?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a moral issue for you, Mr. Workman?
It's not. It's not a moral issue. It's a practical issue. I just don't think. I think it's an ugly and a dishonest tax on the poor of this country. I'm sure you saw the article sometime back in the American Statesman about one fellow that was spending $600 a month or something on scratch-off tickets. And, you know, he's just trying to raise revenue on the backs of the people who can least afford it.
Well, it's a free country.
I understand that, but
Even if that gambling revenue were to be dedicated to a specific purpose, say public education, you're not for that.
No.
Mr. Isaac, what about other kinds of revenue? So Senator Williams is talking about, he, among others, is talking about an increase in the car tag fee, registration fee, with the possibility that by increasing that fee, you might see over time several billion dollars come into the state treasury. What about something like that? That's a semantic game in the minds of some people. Is it a fee or is it a tax? But if we call it a fee, are you for something like that?
No, I'm not. I think we hide a lot of fees to avoid calling them taxes, and I basically see fees as another tax.
So you wouldn't support a plan like that?
No, not at all. It's just, again, we're raising our fees. We're looking for additional sources of revenue on the backs of Texans that we're basically increasing their expenses. We need to learn to do more with less. We've got to increase our efficiencies, as Larry said, and again, make some tough cuts and just be as efficient and lean as we can possibly be without having, you know, to penalize Texans. And that's one of those things that's going to come down hard, particularly on the trucking industry.
Right, when you come down to transportation.
When you raise those registration
right, yeah.
fees, and we've seen that yeah. in the past, where registration fees have gone up, tag fees have gone up. Gross margins tax was a huge hit to the trucking industry.
Right.
That gets passed down to us and increases in our cost of goods.
Mr. Gonzalez, what about fee increases, whether it's the car tag specifically, maybe they increase the fee for a hunting and fishing license in Texas, something. Well, how would you feel about that?
I don't think so, because again, the premise is we're trying to raise to get here, and I want to cut to get here. And I think those conversations begin the dialogue of how we do this, and that's just fundamentally a different approach to where I'm looking at it, which is...
Mr. Gonzalez, though, there are people, some in the audience, but many out in Texas, social services organizations. There was a press conference yesterday by a group of these organizations who believe that under current conditions, public education is not sufficiently funded. Higher education is not sufficiently funded. Health care is not sufficiently funded. You're talking about not only not giving them more money, but you're talking about giving them less. When you could simply raise fees, it might not be felt by most Texans too
right.
hard, and at least try to stem some of that. You don't want to do that.
Now, I think if you look at what we did in Williamson County, the city of Round Rock's general fund has gone from $86 million to $84 million to $81 million. They get it. The Williamson County budget has done the very same thing. The state's done the very same thing. To me, that's the more responsible action, is to see if you can cut your spending to match your revenues. I mean, that's the basic premise for me. And from where I live and the elected officials that you know, I work with, they've done a good job of doing that. And they understand that it's not easy. And the gravity of what that means is not lost on me.
You think social services in Texas is sufficiently funded?
I think everything that we do in Texas is going to be looked at and prioritized.
But do you think it's sufficiently funded today? Do you think there's enough money for public ed, enough money for higher ed, enough money for health care?
You could never have enough money for all of it, Evan. I mean, ideally, you could go on all day with the list, and the list can go longer and longer and longer. But at some point, as legislators and the responsibility of what we've been given with our constituencies is to make certain that we determine what the best programs are, what is the role of government, what should we be doing, and how do we do it efficiently. That means a lot of things are on the table. I've been very honest with my leaders back home, and I've had some very wonderful conversations with my superintendents. They understand. And so what I've done is we've kind of all come together, and we're game planning this together. I've been very honest with those guys, and so we've had some great conversations about what it all means. We've met with the indigent healthcare people there in Williamson County as well, and we've toured the facilities and gone over the budgets. It's not lost on me what it means, but it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But those are the decisions that we're going to have to make.
Mr. Workman, you're prepared to make those same cuts. You're prepared to argue for no new revenue, but to cut healthcare, cut education. You think that we can do that?
Look, there's no question but what we have got to continue to invest in our infrastructure, whether it's roads or higher education. Primarily those two. We've got to figure out a way we're going to pay for roads in the future. We've got to make sure that our higher education universities are top quality, first tier universities, and that's going to take money to do it. We met with the president of UT yesterday, and one of the concerns that he has is that there's going to be a talent drain with other universities outside of the state coming in and grabbing up of talent. Faculty, because they won't have the money to support them, and that's a very real concern. The transportation issue is a huge issue. We've got to figure out how we're going to do that. I just keep going back to my friend Kenny and saying, at this time, I don't see how we can afford to do it. But I do think between now and next session, we have got to have some very real and very serious conversations about how we're going to fund roads, how we're going to fund increased funding for higher education so that we can make sure that the economy of Texas is as strong in the future as it is today, and we've got to do everything we can today to keep it that way.
Under what scenario could you imagine increasing funding for higher education within this budget footprint?
Not in this budget at all.
You're saying outside of this budget?
Outside of this budget.
In the future. In the next one. Let me ask you, Mr. Workman, about the rainy day fund. There are varying estimates on what the size of the rainy day fund will be. There was one sense a couple months ago it might be as little as $8 billion. I know that the Lieutenant Governor's office is talking a little bit about, optimistically, about the possibility that the rise in gas prices has resulted in an increase, and maybe it's as much as $10 billion, whether it's 8 or 10. The House and the Senate have to vote, in each case, two-thirds to touch a dollar right. of the rainy day fund. Would you be a vote to take all or some of the rainy day fund out and apply it to the shortfall?
Perhaps as much as half of it, but no more than half.
So you would potentially, so you're saying you would or you might support?
I might support as
you
much
might
as
support it,
half.
But you might support only up to half, no
yeah.
more than half.
No more than half.
Mr. Isaac?
Yeah, when you get up to more than half, you're going to affect our bond ratings and it's going to increase our debt. So potentially up to half, but not to balance the budget. I'd like to see some of the rainy day fund used to provide tax relief to businesses that have been affected by the gross margins tax and to property tax payers in the state of Texas. I believe those taxes are just too high, and I know it's tough. A lot of people think, well, you can't cut taxes at this point in time. It's actually going to spur growth and revenue in the state of Texas, and I think it'll have a positive effect.
So the theory here is drain part of the rainy day fund, but not to stem some of the need for cuts created by the shortfall, but to provide tax relief on top of the cuts that you're going to make anyway. So you'll treat the rainy day fund as if it has no bearing on the shortfall?
Ideally, yes.
Is that how you feel too, Mr. Workman?
Well, not necessarily. I think we need to look at the whole picture when we get to that point and figure out. And if we need some of it to help balance the budget, I'd probably be okay with that.
Mr. Gonzalez, where do you come down on this?
I feel that's what it's there for. You know, we in previous legislatures, the money's been put aside.
You're there for tax relief or to help avoid some cuts resulting
from
the shortfall?
I mean, you know, recently, obviously, we put more money in there for the purposes of tax relief. That's the past several sessions that's been going on. But I look at that as a source of income to be tapped when we needed it. And
if it's not raining today, when is it raining?
Right. Right. And then that's like, right. And, right. And that's the point, was that it's raining. And so, I'm okay with going into that. I'm not sure what the percentage number we're talking about. But if you're asking me, are you open to, opening up that fund yet?
Well, Mr. Isaac and Mr. Workman are saying they wouldn't be for more than half. You have a position on that?
I'm not going to put a number on it.
You might be willing to take the whole thing out.
No.
So somewhere less than the whole thing.
Yeah, because like Jason said, I mean, you know, that money is there, and it does affect your bond ratings and things, so I wouldn't do that.
Let me ask the three of you a broad question about the message of last November. You represent three of, I guess it's now, Ross, 38 people will be in the in the House who were not in the House last time, and of those 38, three are returning, so it's really 35 new people, but that's actually more than 20% of the House is turning over, and it's all new folks. What do you think, as three of the people who were elected as part of this big wave, what do you think the message was? I mean, I know that you're handsome and charismatic and all that, but that's not why you got elected. Why'd you get elected? If we take your looks and your charisma off the table, what was it that got you elected?
Well, those aren't on the table for me, but I think that answer, there's no one variable. If you look at all the races across the state, I think each of us have our own message. Each of us has something that we were delivering, that we were talking about, that we're messaging, that the people responded to. I don't think you can have a blanket answer for every single state, every single district in the state.
So why did you get elected then? Let's just talk about you.
Williamson County is a place where I've been involved with for a very long time. A lot of roots there, have been very involved there. And we just ran a race that was based on the conservative principles of HD 52.
Is that just simply conservative principles matched up with the constituents' desires, and that's the end of it?
I believe so.
Mr. Isaac, unlike Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Gonzalez's district was a Republican district session before last. In your case, you had a member who had been elected in 02, seated in 03. It was been a Democratic district for the last couple of years. What happened in your case, you think?
I think there was a big anti-incumbent movement that was prevalent in our district. I think I had support from both sides and from the middle as well.
Right.
But I think it came down to work ethic. And my wife, our two boys, and I just worked our tails off during the campaign. And at the completion of the campaign, And some people are like, wow, I hope you get to take a break. And I said, no, this I'm going to make it look like the campaign was easy, and now the real work begins.
You ran against a guy who had a pretty good work ethic historically.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, and was very good at raising money.
Right. And including one of the people who helped raise money for your opponent was the Speaker of the House.
Yes, yes.
That you guys made up over that.
Yeah, it helped my campaign significantly. So I told him he couldn't have planned it any better.
Is that right? It helped you. It helped your campaign. How exactly did it help your campaign?
It brought the base around me. Right. It really did. They unified behind me as their candidate. I didn't have a primary opponent. And so it really did help motivate some people in the district to work with me to have a successful campaign.
But ideologically, temperamentally, you ran a campaign that you thought was, again, like Mr. Gonzalez, in line with the principles of your district.
Absolutely. It was one that not a career politician, not an incumbent, not a lawyer. And that was usually my short parade speech, and it worked very well, and it was received very well. But, yes, and it did line up with the district.
Mr. Workman, your district had been sort of in between these two in terms
right.
of Mrs. Bolton had been in there for a couple terms and had been Republican held before. Talk about what you think was the factor that resulted in your winning.
Well, we worked very hard throughout the entire campaign. Had a tough primary, as you know, and that probably helped us get some name ID and some thicker skin, and we worked hard to go through that. But I'll tell you, there is a national element to it, and I don't think you can deny that there was a great deal of anger building up amongst people who might otherwise have stayed home over what was going on in Washington. And I'd be disingenuous if I acted like it was all me. I think we benefited from.
There was indeed a wave.
I think so.
We got about 5 minutes left. I want to ask each of you a question just directed specifically to you, and then we're going to open it up for the audience's questions. Mr. Isaac, let me start with you. You are, as I said, a member of this Tea Party caucus that Senator Patrick pulled together. It's only a couple senators. I think it's Senator Patrick and Senator Birdwell, and the remaining members of the caucus are members of the House. What does that mean? And more specifically, what role will the Tea Party have in this session? There's a lot of discussion about, can the Tea Party incorporate the Republican Party? Can the Republican Party incorporate the Tea Party? Is there going to be some civil war? Talk about that, please.
I think we're in a unique situation. I think our current president has done a fantastic job of bringing people into politics. We saw that with his election, and we've seen that with the last election. Whether they're for him or against him, more people are involved in this process. Some of them go by Tea Party. There are other groups out there as well. So I think it was a really good idea to put this caucus together so that we can reach this group, because they don't affiliate with a particular party such as the Republican Party, the Democrat Party, Libertarian. They like to kind of be an independent, but they are conservatives, and they want a strong conservative fiscal government. They want constitutional government. And I think it's important that we do have this caucus. I believe we have our first meeting on the 19th of this month, where we're inviting outside Tea Party leaders to come and speak to us and tell us what their concerns are. And it's just a great opportunity for us to just sit back and listen.
But can the halves of the party, if you accept the premise that there are halves, be squared? You know, I saw on the Red State blog, Mr. Workman, some folks commenting about you in the speaker's race, and what they're saying is, well, if Workman votes for Strauss, Holly Turner's not going to have a residency problem next time. You know, the fact is that all three of you, like other new members of the House who have yet to show a preference in the speaker's race or on other issues, are being put on notice. The Texans for Fiscal Responsibility Group and Americans for Prosperity and the Eagle Forum, they're going to wait this speaker's vote, and they're going to run people against you if you don't toe the line. Doesn't Mr. Isaac, Mr. Workman, don't you all have a problem in the party of how you square the people who are absolutists with people who are not?
I'm running, will be representing House District 45, and I got in this to represent House District 45 and do what I thought was best and listen to the people within the district and do what is best for House District 45. If next primary season people don't think that I have done what's best and they choose someone else, then that's great. Then their voices will be heard, and that's what's most important.
You're not going to be cowed by that prospect.
No.
Yeah. And Mr. Workman, Mr. Gonzalez, you both ran and won very contentious primaries in your districts. You both know what that's like. The prospect of a primary opponent is not going to cause you to vote differently during this session.
Absolutely not.
Do what's principally right.
Okay. Mr. Workman, you come out of the construction business, a business that has an interesting place in the conversation about immigration. You know that Bill Hammond of the Texas Association of Business, who is a great champion for business in this state, is nonetheless opposed to a lot of the Arizona-style immigration proposals that have been raised by some members of your legislature, people who will soon be your colleagues. He is absolutely out opposed to the E-Verify program. I wonder, as a business owner who may well have had some employment decisions that tie back to the question of the flow of undocumented people coming into this country, I wonder where you come down on this and how, as a member, you will address some of these issues as they come up on the floor.
Well, first of all, in the Arizona matter, I fully support Arizona's right to do what they did. Now, whether or not that legislation could be imposed in Texas, I don't know. I think we have to do what's right for Texas, but I certainly agree with their right to do that.
Do you think that kind of a law would be appropriate for Texas?
I don't know whether it would or not. I mean, I thought some of those laws were already on the books, but nevertheless, I think we have to look at what's right for Texas and deal with it in that respect.
Where do you put yourself on the continuum, on the immigration reform continuum? Are you a Debbie Riddle type immigration reform person, or are you a George W. Bush type immigration reform person?
Well, look, until we do something to stop the free flow of immigrants coming north, talk about what to do with them is irrelevant, because if you go and pass some law, then you're likely going to invite thousands more to come across. And until we can figure out how to secure the border, then I don't really think we need to talk a whole lot about what to do with the ones that are here. Now, are we going to load them up on buses and haul them south? No, I don't think we're going to do that. And we have to figure out a way for those people to come out of the shadows and pay the taxes that they're not paying and be productive people. They don't have to be citizens. I don't think that they need to go down a path of citizenship necessarily, but I do think that we need to get the border secure first, and then we'll talk about what to do with those folks that are here.
Mr. Gonzalez, finally to you. When Representative Aaron Pena switched from the Democratic to the Republican Party, Representative Pete Gallego, Democrat of Alpine, was adamant in saying that Mr. Pena was leaping into the arms of a party whose agenda is exactly opposed to what Hispanics in Texas want and need and deserve. You are one of six Hispanic Republicans who will enter a House of Representatives that had zero last session. Would you talk about whether being Hispanic and being Republican are incompatible, how you view what Representative Gallego is suggesting about what it means to be a Hispanic Republican these days?
I absolutely think that it is more in line. Growing up in the culture, with the family, the values that we have growing up, you know, it was instilled in me early on what our ethics were. And it was hard work and commitment and dedication and family. And these are the things that were drilled into me from my grandfather and his third grade education to my father with an aerospace engineering degree. I guess I kind of brought the pulled down now, but so.
If you're in the communications business, you are the black sheep of the family.
But I think when you look at, I gave a speech to the Hispanic Republicans of Texas, and the one thing I said was, I'm not going to preach to my Hispanic colleagues why you should be a Republican or a conservative. What I said was, I will model it in my everyday life, in church, in my community, at work, with my family. I'm not here to preach to Hispanics why you should be conservative. Just watch us and see what my values are and see how I live my life and how my family lives their lives and how my friends and my colleagues live their lives. And I think you'll see that those are conservative principles. I think going forward, what this session looks like for me as one of the Hispanic Republicans, I paid my MALC dues and I'm officially a member of the Mexican American Legislative Caucus. It's an opportunity this time to have a discussion that's going to be a little more diverse. There's going to be a different viewpoint coming in, because I don't think you can take all Hispanics and put them into some monolithic group that you're here. I think what we've shown, especially this past election cycle, is we are diverse and we do have differing opinions, just like any other subgroup out there. And I think we're ready for that. And I think we're going to make a pretty strong case this session as Hispanic Republicans that the terms are not mutually exclusive, that you can be a conservative Hispanic. And the dialogue you're going to see this time, it will be different. I think it'll be an opportunity to show some diversity.
Well, we are out of time for my portion of this. Let us give a big hand and thank Representatives Gonzalez, Isaac, Van Wertheim. And we have about 20 minutes for questions from the audience. We didn't talk about redistricting. Might I suggest somebody ask about that? We have other things that we could probably talk about, but let me open the floor for you all. We have only one handheld mic, and it is mine. And so if you have a question, raise your hand. I will repeat your question if we can't hear it, and then we'll let these guys jump on. Questions for the audience. I will ask questions if you don't. So, Mr. England and then Ms. Neibel.
Just a quick follow-up on your immigration question and Mr. Workman's response. What can the state of Texas do to stem the tide of illegal immigrants so that we can actually address the immigration problem that you don't want to talk about until we do?
What can we do to stem the tide of illegal immigrants so that we get to the point where we can talk about the problem, as Mr. Workman said?
Well, I think the state of Texas has got a task force that works the border, primarily related to drug trade, and that's really where we need to focus right now, is to try to do something about the drug trade, human trafficking, and that sort of thing. I'm not sure that the state of Texas, in the big picture, can do a lot to really stem the tide. It's got to be a federal issue. I visited Brownsville and went to the fence, and a lot of people think that the wall is the answer to that, but the wall's got lots of holes in it. And the place that I went to, there was about a 40-foot gap with a road that went right down to the river, and no cameras, nobody else around, so they just, I'm not quite sure why we did what we did. But we've got to get the federal government, and I don't think they want to solve the problem, but we do need to get the federal government to fix that problem, and then we can talk about what to do with those that are here.
Either of you want to answer this question. I know it's directed at Mr. Workman, but I'd be curious to know if either of you has a point of view about this you want to offer.
We do, and we need workers. There's no doubt about it, but we need them here, and we need them documented. And it is easier for someone to come across this border and cost them less money to use the services of a coyote. It costs about $5,000 for you to pay and come across this border illegally into this country, and that's... We've got this frame set where that's easier and takes less time than going through the legal processes because there are so many perceived layers of corruption on the Mexican side of the border. I think we need to work with our neighbors to the south and see what we can't do to fix the problems and so that we have these people that are coming over here and that are documented. Also, you've got a lot of people that are fleeing Arizona right now that are undocumented immigrants, and they're going to states where they can get driver's licenses. They're going to New Mexico. They're going to Oregon. They're going to Washington. We've got to make sure that we're not providing additional incentives to attract illegal immigrants here in this state so that we can curb the tide of the illegal immigrants and the undocumented workers. Then we're going to be able to, the people that really just want to come across the border at that point in time are going to be the people that want to do us harm or they're trafficking drugs. So we're going to basically eliminate the haystack and it'll be just that bad needle or needles that are coming across and really help us filter some of the problems.
Mr. Gonzalez?
This is part of the reprioritizing, reevaluating what we do as a state government. And if we as the legislature see that, you know, investing our funds with our officers along the southern border, if that's a priority to us to keep our citizens safe, then that's the investment you make. Because for me, when you have the illegal immigration issue, I frame it as that's kind of the umbrella, and then you have all the subgroups. And I'm with Paul, and the first one is border security. Then we need to step up and make sure that we have a physical presence, that they have the tools they need, whether that's manpower or equipment, and make the investment on the security side.
Mr. Workman and Governor Perry, for that matter, both believe, maybe you both do as well, that this is really a federal issue. That the problem is not that we have dropped the ball, it's that the federal government's dropped the ball. You think so?
I believe that completely. I think when a federal government abdicates their responsibility and the president will complain about a patchwork of state legislation, well, it's that way because the federal government hasn't stepped up and done their job. And so our responsibility is to this state. And if the federal government won't step up, we will. And we will do what we think is right for the citizens of Texas.
Mr. Isaac, you agree?
Yes.
Ms. Neibel.
Thank you all for being here. My question is on health care and a little bit more personal. I'm on Medicare. I have adequate insurance. But if I need to go to the emergency room and it is filled with people who don't have access to primary care,
what do we do about people who are in emergency rooms with no access to primary care? If you have insurance and you go, I'm assuming, Ms. Neville, you're saying there's a huge jam up of people in emergency rooms right now, and many people are using it as their primary care facility. What do we do? Mr. Isaac.
Well, there's a whole bunch of issues in that one question right there. I was a very fortunate church that we have been a part of, my wife and our family. They opened up a clinic in their church to see people on Fridays. And they had doctors that donated their time. They had nurses that donated their time. There was medications available. But it gave an outlet for people to come in that didn't need emergency care, an opportunity to come in, and no questions asked, get help that they needed. And this is something that they could plan on. It was a free clinic run by a nonprofit. I think we need to see some more of that. You talk a little bit about the Medicaid. The funding mechanism, in my opinion, is just not right there. For every 25 cents that we put into Medicaid, we get, or every 40 cents we put into Medicaid, we get 60 cents back from the federal government. For every 25 cents in CHIP, we get 75 cents back from the federal government. Those are incentives for us to spend more money so that we can get more of our tax dollars back into this state. We need to find out how we can keep those tax dollars here in the first place and just be more efficient with our tax dollars.
Here's what's wrong with federal tax dollars.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there's too many strings attached.
Well, see, you brought a prop, and you got to use it.
I finally got to use my prop.
It took a little while, but we got the prop out. You know that there was a discussion almost immediately after the election. Representative Chisholm and others talked openly about the possibility of withdrawing from the federal Medicaid program. For or against, Mr. Workman?
We can't do that. I mean, the feds, they weren't stupid. They set this up and put us on heroin, and we can't get off of it. And there's no way that we can opt out of the Medicaid program, because there's no way that we can step in and fill what's that 75 cents or 60 cents that's being spent. I mean, it's...
Well, it sounds like Mr. Isaac, though, is for going into rehab.
Yeah, if we could keep the money here, that'd be great, and not send it to the federal government. Hey, here's the money that you've had for the last couple of years for Medicaid and CHIP. You keep it, you manage it.
But practically speaking, would you support a plan to withdraw from federal Medicaid?
Not with the way it's set up now. No, it costs
too much
money.
We can't get there. I mean, the numbers just aren't there.
Okay. Other questions? Let me go in the very back and then come forward. I'm not trying to not look at this side. And then, Mr. Heflin, he knows a couple things about this issue. We'll come back to him. Sir.
Our table this morning is a document talking about the future of public pension funds. And so my question is, what do you think are the condition of public pension funds in the state of Texas and pensioners in general?
Anybody take this? Question is, what's the condition of public pension funds in Texas and pensioners in general?
Wow.
I don't know enough about it.
We go back to this.
Maybe I ask you about the speaker's vote again. Huh?
Now, I think going back to 2007, when TRS was having their issues when they wanted the 13th check, working for Representative Otto, we had a good opportunity to look in depth at kind of what those funds look like and the actuarial soundness of those funds. And, when you look at TRS in 2007, they wanted some greater tools by which to invest, similar to what ERS mm-hmm. had wanted. And so we agreed in principle and said, okay, go ahead and do that. Unfortunately, what happened was when TRS made this huge investment and kind of getting more aggressive, if you will, the timing was terrible. The market was shortly after that, went down quite a bit. It was the right idea. The timing was bad. The pension funds are definitely on the table for discussion, because you see our ERS and our TRS employees, the public pensions funds, these guys have been at a certain level for a very long time. And all of us, but I mean, when you have as many state employees who live in your district as we do, the districts we represent, that's something that I hear about quite often, actually. Because of the proximity to the hub of state government, there are a lot of ERS and employees there in 52. So it's something that we talk about quite a bit. And but the funds, as per the market go, that's where we are. And that's as volatile as it comes right now.
In fact, you all have districts with probably a lot of state employees,
exactly right.
Given the proximity to Austin.
That's exactly right.
Either of you, Mr. Workman, you say you don't know enough about it.
Well, I don't know much about it, although I've been told that the state pension fund is funded at about 82%, which is generally considered safe and okay. But beyond that, I really don't know a lot about it. I had an interesting comment from a retired teacher who told me that, that she was explaining the difference between defined benefits plans and defined contribution plans, and that they thought that they need to stay with defined benefit plans because teachers just didn't know how to manage their money. And I thought to myself, these are people that are teaching our students and they can't manage their own money. So that's kind of the mindset that's out there from that.
Sir, right here, yes, sir.
Well, I thought I'd help Evan out with redistricting.
Thank you.
all three of you obviously wanted swing districts, you big Democrats, and it seems to me generally that all three of you are probably in overpopulated districts, sir. How do you see, Paul, I'll address this to you first, I guess. How do you see Travis County? Are we going to pick up another seat or half a seat, or how do you see?
You're talking about congressional, obviously, right?
No.
You're talking about legislative?
State.
Okay.
State story.
Okay.
Well, again, being a freshman, I don't know a whole lot about how that process works. I assume that the lines will be redrawn some way, and I don't know whether we'll pick up a seat, but we are overpopulated, I think, relative to the state. I think there were like 170,000 in my district or something like that. So they'll be redrawn, Carol, but I don't know how yet. I just don't know enough about it.
Mr. Smith asked a good question because on the one hand, you know, you all are entering a process that
right.
you don't know a whole lot about. It is believed that it will be difficult for even the most optimistic Republicans to draw maps that preserve every single one of the seats that you all won this last time. Some of you, in fact, might be at risk going into the next election.
Terrell, what Williamson County looks like for us is right now there are two districts, 20 and 52, that cover Williamson and Milam County. Okay, so think two members, two counties. We are just short of having three entirely within Williamson County. That's the kind of growth that we've seen. So everything that we've seen and heard will put an additional House seat in Williamson County. There'll be three. Now, there's going to have to be some leakage into some surrounding areas because we can't quite get there just with three. But that's the kind of growth that we've seen. I mean, if you look at the map and you see this incredible depopulation of rural East and West Texases, I mean, they're coming to the centers, right? It's urban and suburban now, and Williamson County is a huge part of that. So when you look at that map and that little glowing red section that is, you know, HD 52 and HD 20, there's no doubt that we're going to have to pick up that extra House seat there in Williamson County.
Mr. Isaac?
It'll be interesting to see how things shake out. And I've got three counties, Blanco, Hays, and Caldwell counties. Hays is one of the fastest growing counties in the country. It'll be interesting to see how the maps are drawn. I don't suspect I'll be on the redistricting committee, but I would imagine that I'll lose a portion of the current district as it is right now.
Is there any way for this to avoid being a political football? I mean, redistricting last time couldn't have been any more problematic from a political standpoint. Is there any way to avoid this being, if not a direct repeat of what happened last time, something that comes close to blowing up the session?
I think the maps that we have done in the past and the way we've done things in the past have worked well. And I think my district specifically speaks well to that, since we haven't had a representative longer than 8 years, since before the 50s. And so I think we've had this district that's been kind of, you know, like you said, a swing district, that it allows people, hey, when they're fed up with somebody, they're going to put somebody else in there. And it hasn't built a career politician. So I think from our district standpoint, the way the process has gone has served us well.
Jason makes a good point about the political process and how it's going back and forth. And so I'm not sure that you need to change the way the system's done.
Mr. Heflin.
I'll piggyback on Carol's question. The group sufficiently danced around the budget question, so I don't think I need to go into that.
You'd want to pin them down a little bit more for me? All right. Great question. Mr. Heflin asked, will your focus in redistricting be on protecting communities of interest or trying to preserve the 101 seat majority? Again, you may take issue with this notion that you guys can't draw a map that saves 101 seats, but
well, that presumes that we'll have some influence over the redistricting.
The three of you.
Yeah. Three.
Well, I mean you in the royal sense, you know.
In the royal. You know, I think it's going to wind up in the legislative redistricting board and maybe even in the courts. I don't know how it's going to wind up. Personally, I just think that we need to have a system that's as fair as possible, that represents the entire state and its population.
I think it's important that we protect those communities. I think the redistricting, at least on the House level, we try not to break county lines except when necessary, and I think that's important.
Mr. Workman, I'm going to, Mr. Heflin, move the question a tiny bit over here to ask something that off the Mr. Workman said. Mr. Workman mentioned the word fair, which kind of makes me think. What is your position about the Democrats? You have the numbers to jam it up their noses every day if you want to. But you don't necessarily have to. You could. You have the numbers to do it. What should your position be? Should whoever the new speaker is stick it to the Democrats on committee chairmanships? Should you guys put voter ID on the local and consent calendar? Should you all basically be jamming...
Local consent. No.
Should you basically be jamming it up... Is that, should you be jamming it up the Democrats' noses every day simply because you can? Or is fairness, Mr. Workman, more... the goal here?
Look, Texas has a long history of leaving the party labels outside the Capitol when you walk in and working together for the good of the state. And I submit to you that part of the reason that the state of Texas is in good a shape as it is because we do that. We walk in there and I'm the only Republican in the Travis County delegation. But yet, I'm going to work very hard with all of those folks to make sure that things go well for Travis County as well as the state of Texas. And I think that, I mean, you talk about fair or unfair, but I think that we have to do what's right for the state of Texas. And I think the Democrats think that too.
Won't have a problem working with the Democrats?
Absolutely not.
Numbers don't give you the reason to think we don't need to work
no.
with them. Mr. Gonzalez?
I think 150 of us were duly elected, and everyone has their say, and you work together as a team to do what's best. We'll disagree sometimes and agree some other times, but at the end of the day, it takes all of us.
Mr. Isaac, same?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and there's a lot of people out there. We get emails every day that say, hey, you know, just tell them to go to Oklahoma. You don't need them anymore. You guys can get business done. Get the business done of the state. And that's not how we work once we get inside that building. We are going to have to work together. There's going to be a lot of local bills where we're going to need expertise of other representatives and what their county commissioners are thinking, what their constituents are thinking. How does this bill impact their community? We're going to have to work together. There's no way about it.
We're going to call it there. This has been a great morning. Let us thank Representatives Gonzalez, Isaac, and Workman. We will see you next week, hopefully, for Representative Jim Pitts, Thursday morning at 7:30. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Evan.
Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.